The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've appreciated being here today with all of you, appreciating that the people would come for a day long, and apparently some of you didn't expect to have a silent day long, and so some of you came and sat here, sitting and walking all day, and it's a wonderful thing. I think so. I think it's one of the most important things we do here at IMC is these silent day longs, where each person has a chance to meet themselves, practice with themselves, without input from the outside, which is useful, teachings and input and instructions. But there's a limit to how far you can do with instructions and input and these teachers. It's good to kind of, if necessary at some point, just to be left with oneself in the practice and meet oneself and not have the distractions of a lot of new information, new teachings, new things. And so I think it's very important, so I appreciate very much. And it's a little bit inspired by your motivation to be here and engage in this practice this way. I want to talk some about motivation in practice. And start by bringing up a very important concept in Mahayana Buddhism, which is the idea of bodhicitta. And the word bodhi means, usually translated into English, as awakening, sometimes as enlightenment. And citta here is usually translated as thought, the thought of awakening. It also can mean mind, so the mind of awakening. And more often than not in Mahayana Buddhism, it's taken to mean the aspiration for awakening, the dedication, the motivation for it. And if you go back and try to look at the earlier teachings of Buddhism, there's not really a comparable concept there. It's kind of like just taken for granted that people will be motivated to practice. The closest you would get, I think, to the emotional motivation or the emotional kind of tone or the drive or the inspiration would be in the various uses of the word sadha or faith. But because that this early tradition doesn't have, the, as far as I know, the word for this kind of this aspiration, the movement for liberation, a kind of a concept to hold that, it's useful to maybe talk a little bit about this bodhicitta. In the Zen tradition where I studied in, the Zen master Dogen, Zen teacher in Japan in the 12th century, 13th century, he defined this very important Mahayana term of bodhicitta as the mind that sees the world of impermanence. The insight into impermanence is bodhicitta. And this is a little bit of a surprise, because bodhicitta is over and over again is used as the aspiration for awakening. And what's the connection between seeing impermanence and the aspiration for awakening? And I think there can be a very profound connection, that the deeper the insight into this changing nature of our world, the rising and passing of phenomena, the more I think it becomes almost instinctual to want to move towards freedom. There's something about the free flow of reality, the flow of experience that we can see, we perceive, we have as we deepen in this practice, that lends itself to kind of a movement towards removing the wind drag, removing the resistance to how things can flow and how things can move. And so the more we have a sense of how things are constantly in flux and changing, the more sensitive we become to the ways in which we block that, or we hold on to things, or we're stuck in some idea of permanence, and this is how it is, or we're resisting change, or we're holding on. And the more sensitive we become to that, the more we can feel the inadequacy and the unsatisfactoriness of clinging to things or resisting to this flow of reality, the changing nature of things arising and passing, coming and going. Things appear, things disappear, things are born, things die. And we become increasingly sensitive to our relationship to that world, and it stands out and highlight as the holding or the tightening or the closing down that might go on. All these kinds of ways the mind reacts in to the world of change and impermanence. And as we sense that and see that more deeply, the desire to become free becomes, at some point, becomes paramount. It just becomes, I think there's almost a natural instinct to move to that, that I don't see it much different than if you put your hand on the hot stove, you remove your hand. Or if you step, you know, you step on a thorn and it's embedded in your soles of your feet, you don't just keep walking, you know, let it go deeper and deeper, you pull it out. It's kind of that natural, it's like that instinct to remove that suffering is. And so at some point, the insight into how things change gives rise to what I call a biological imperative for awakening, for freedom. And the reason I call it biological is because it doesn't really feel like it comes from the usual kind of sense of self or the egotistical desires we have or that drive many people in their choices of what they do and their desires and aversions. It seems to come from someplace deeper than the ordinary kind of egotistical mind. And so I'd like to refer to that as biological. So maybe there's a better word, but that's what I'd, for the time being, that's what I've come up with. And then imperative, biological imperative, it's not like there's any should that we have to do this. There's no, I don't think the Buddha or Buddhism, I don't see it as anybody has the obligation to become liberated and become free or do this practice. However, there can arise out of this biological system of ours a feeling that this is what's most important. This is what the system wants. You know, the biological imperative to pull a thorn out of the out of your foot. Is that an imperative, or you know, or is just you know, it's completely fine. Just keep walking in it, pushing that in more and more. The more thorns, the better, probably, right? I think there's a kind of a, you know, kind of an imperative to pull the hand off the stove. Or so again, that may be my choice of words, and maybe you have another word that works better. and some people. This bodhicitta, the thought of awakening, desire for awakening, is, you know, it's not very, they can't really articulate why they practice. There are some people, including for me at times, where it was like really clearly the most important thing that I was going to do was to do this Buddhist practice. But if you ask me why I was doing it, I couldn't quite put, you know, I didn't have good reason. And I'm a person who likes to have reasons. I'm kind of a, you know, a rational kind of person, right? Probably some of you have noticed that already. And you know, to have this, you know, to get up and sit every day and every day. And the first time I had this experience of not having a reason for my meditation practice was in college. And I was sitting 40 minutes twice a day. And that's a lot of time for college students. And when I, some of you are from Davis, this was in Davis this happened, that I had this thought that I was, and I was like, why am I doing this? And I couldn't, I didn't have a reason. But I kept doing it. Now that's strange, you should have a reason for what you do. And I just kept doing it. And eventually I came up with a reason. Kind of, and the reason that was most satisfying for me at the time, and that is that I wasn't doing it for any other reason except to express myself. Something was arising within me that wanted to come out, and the meditation, the sitting, was the way that this was going to surface and arise. And it wasn't like, you know, some deep, difficult things that were going to arise. It was just life, almost. It was like just being present and being here in a full way. That's what wanted to come out. And so the way I likened it to an artist who you know, has no reason for art except to express. Or dancers, they don't, you know, might say, why are you dancing? To express myself. You know, just the expressions coming out, maybe. So it kind of felt that way for me. And so I felt very lucky to have, in retrospect, to have this, that, you know, this biological urge, biological instinct, movement, that didn't always have reasons. It just felt this goodness that was bubbling up and coming. Other times I had very clear reasons. If I look back over all that many reasons I had for practicing over my many years, I think the one that feels, one of the ones that feels the most satisfying is, let me tell you a little story before I tell you. Mm-hmm. So I'd been practicing for quite a while, and then I went to a meditation center in Massachusetts called the Insight Meditation Society to do a 3-month retreat. And I ran into the teacher of the retreat when I first day I was there in the hallways or something, Joseph Goldstein. And he asked me, you know, why are you here? What's your motivation? And you know, I was a little taken by surprise by why am I there? It's a reasonable question, but, you know, I was just there to practice. So I said to him, I'm here to overcome suffering, to become free of my suffering. And I walked away and said, boy, you know, Gil, you've been practicing for a long time, you're a Zen priest, you should have a more sophisticated answer. But no. That's like one of the best answers. That's a great answer. And it was sincere, but I was just like, you know, in the moment I was taken by surprise, and that's what came out. There was a man in the time of the Buddha's life who had been a monk, Sunakata, and he left the monastic life, and he went to town, and the story came back, from town and said, this guy, Sunakata, he's out there in the town criticizing you, condemning you. One of the things, he says many things about you, but one of the things he says about you is that you merely teach suffering and the end of suffering. Merely. Because he was expecting, what this guy wanted was a teacher who, you know, did all kinds of miracles and psychic feats and psychic powers, and, you know, Buddha wasn't doing enough of them for him, for what he wanted, because he merely teaches, you know, suffering and suffering. So the Buddha heard this and he said, that foolish man Sunakata, he doesn't know that he's actually praising the Buddha when he says that. So this, you know, to become free of suffering. But there are many motivations that can get people to practice. For some people, it is to kind of get away from, you know, to use a kind of a metaphor, to get away from the darkness, the difficulties of their life. For other people, they have an instinct that they're moving towards the light, to something beautiful and wonderful. And they're both walking the same path. One person's looking over their shoulder at the difficulties, and that's what's propelling them. Someone else is looking forward and seeing something. But in both those cases, being propelled by the difficulties and by looking towards the potential that's up ahead, it's very important not to get lost in the past or lost in the future. But again, to have this something that, at least in my experience, something that wells up from within. We're connected to something. We're really connected to ourselves. It's not an abstraction, the desire that what we should do, but it's more like, you know, for me, this biological imperative, or this expression, or this movement towards, or this something is arising. Especially with the idea of some ideal in the future, looking towards the light. If it's just an abstract ideal, it's not very helpful. But some people, for whatever reason, can have a real intuitive sense of moving towards the light, of moving into some space of greater freedom or greater love or compassion or something. So to have this bodhicitta. Now, one of the things about this word bodhicitta that I find interesting is that it's a little bit ambivalent what it actually, or it's varied what it means, but the word itself, as I said, means the mind of awakening. And so it's often translated as the aspiration for awakening, but that's an interpretive translation of the Sanskrit word. And it literally is the mind of awakening. And so, what I like about that is that a mind of awakening, most literally, I would think, means a mind that is awakened. That's what it means. And sometimes in Mahayana Buddhism, that's what it means. But it's more often defined as the aspiration for that awakening. So which is it? So what's kind of very interesting, I think, is that it's both. And there's a wonderful harmony or alignment between these two. In this way, that when the aspiration for awakening is sincere, the aspiration for freedom is sincere, when the aspiration to be free of suffering is sincere, it has within it qualities of an awakened mind. The awakened mind is not something way out there in the future, but if the goal and the means mirror each other, the means contains elements of the goal. What I mean is that if the goal is not to cling, then the means to that is to start not clinging. If the goal, for example, is to speak a foreign language, the means is to start speaking it. You don't wait until you're fluent and then start speaking. If you want to learn to play a musical instrument and be fluent or skilled in it, you start playing the musical instrument. So there's something, if you want to become free of clinging, you start by doing what you can to be free of clinging. If your goal is to be compassionate, you start by being compassionate to a degree that what you can. And so if the goal is to become free of our egotistical self-preoccupation, the means is to start softening that and letting go of that. And so in this way, the aspiration for awakening should ideally have qualities of the awakening itself. And there's one way of one quality that I think kind of one quality that I think that for this aspiration for practice that maybe kind of is a really good one. To maybe kind of is like the goal, mirrors the goal, or partakes in the goal, shares in parts of the goal. And that is sincerity. To have a sincere practice. And I don't know what exactly how we want to define sincere, but to me it's a wonderful word. A friend of mine recently looked up the word sincere in the dictionary, or on the computer dictionary. I don't know you can see the usages of the word, how the frequency it's used in books, I guess. And the word sincerity has been dropping in popularity. I don't think this is good. So I want to reinfuse it, but into our vocabulary. it seems to come from the Latin word for to be clean or pure. So to have a clean motivation. I associate it with being honest, being truthful. So a truthful, like sincerity is to have a motivation that represents who you are. So it's not, if you're greedy, that's the motivation for fame and gain. That's not really sincere, because that's not really who we are. To be sincere is to come from a place where where we are kind of aligned with a goal, where we're in harmony with what the purpose of the practice is. The purpose of the practice is not to hate better, but to become free of hate. I think that's what the heart wants to do. Not to be greedy better, but be free of greed. I think that's what the heart most wants to do. And so they say of sincerity, to practice sincerely. And we don't practice sincerely if we, in my mind at least, you're welcome to have another view, but in my mind that we don't practice sincerely if we're too caught up in the goal, if we're too greedy or in a hurry to attain something and get something. We don't practice sincerely if we spend a lot of time berating ourselves or being critical of ourselves. We don't practice sincerely if it's a barter and we're bartering. You know, it's an exchange. You know, if I give the Dharma all this time and effort, the Dharma better give me back, awakening. I think there's a kind of in my mind again, that sincerity has a quality of certain healthy kind of humility, or humbleness or something, that is involved in there, and we're making the effort is what's important, giving ourselves to the practice. I like the idea of giving ourselves to the practice as an act of generosity, but we give ourselves to the practice. Kind of without any expectations or any demands in it. Give ourselves to the practice, and then the practice gives itself back to us in some way. And what way that is, we'll find out as we do it. And it varies over time what we get back. Sometimes what we get back is really, really nice, feels really good, very satisfying, the goodness of it. And sometimes what we get back is too much of ourselves. you wanted to get free of all this, then all your shenanigans, all your foibles, or all your what other words were?
Well,
stuff. What's stuff? All your stuff.
Lights.
All your oddities. Or something, come and, face you directly, like, oh my God, I have to deal with this now, and there we sit with that. And that's what the practice gives us. And so we practice with that. And to practice sincerely is you just keep going. Just take the next step. Take the next step. Keep working. Keep doing it. Keep showing up. Keep working with this. Now, some people sometimes protect themselves too much or don't give themselves enough. They hold back in the practice. They're not really willing to open up or to allow the expression to come out. But I like this idea of, what wants to come out? What wants to be expressed here? Because if we're too much the technique focused, if we're too much in charge and wanting and expecting and kind of telling the mind, this is what you have to do, it's limiting. And who knows what's supposed to happen? No one knows. But to practice in such a way that you are willing in certain settings, meditation is, I think, one of the best ones of them, to allow what's inside to surface. Sit in such a way there's room in you for what's inside can be expressed, can come up. And as some of you know, especially when people begin practicing, what wants to come up sometimes is lots of tears. Some people cry. They have, backlog of tears. Some people it's grief, some people it's anger. I've known people who've sat and meditated and boiling anger comes up and finally it's there. That's why, it's nice not to move when it's kind of within reason. It's good to be committed to not moving when you meditate, so that you don't hit anyone. And you're not supposed to talk. So it's like really a good place to be angry. Just sit there. You look serene, but inside it's what wasn't expressed. And this idea of feeling, it's very generous, I think, and very significant to trust this process of expression, what wants to come. The alternative to trusting it, I guess, is to mistrust it. The alternative to trusting it is to bottle it up or resist it or somehow attack it or do something else. And that doesn't work for the inner life. But this purification process, this letting things bubble up and be there and show themselves and don't be afraid that you're going to be stuck. It's actually the movement of the opposite. It's what unstucks it. And the backlog of unresolved issues will come and bubble up and they'll pass. Sometimes it takes a little while. Sometimes it's quick. But to be sincere and be willing to sit and work with what's there. There's a wonderful poem from an ancient Japanese poem. I sort of don't remember very well. But it's something like this. If you take, like in the late winter or something, before everything has blossomed yet, if you take a axe to a cherry tree, you know, and start chopping away at it, you'll never find the blossoms. The blossoms won't come out. But the gentle spring breeze brings forth the blossoms. And, you know, and as many of these Buddhist poems in Japan, they refer to, practice. So you can't force, you can't take an axe to your heart, you can't force something. But what's the gentle spring breeze that brings forth these beautiful cherry blossoms, brings forth the blossoms in our hearts? Sincerity, kindness, dedication, humility, truthfulness, compassion, dedication, determination, courage, strength, honesty, perseverance. Different circumstances, these different qualities come along. And this idea that we bring this gentle breeze of our goodness or of our love and our care and our practice, and then something will blossom. You don't find, it's very hard, to, at least with the eyes, normal eyes, regular eyes, to find in the cherry tree that which is going to blossom into in the middle of the winter. But it's there. What's in the middle of your winter that's waiting for the spring breeze? And can you bring the spring breeze? Now, some people don't want to blossom, of course. And so it's nice to think that a flower bud is still not a flower. It has to open to become a flower. Or I like this little saying, a ship was not made to stay in the harbor. It was made to go out to sea where it's dangerous. So, you know, if you're always just, you know, your heart's not made to stay protected and closed and resistant and spending too much time on the internet. You know, it's made for, you know, let it blossom. So I have tremendous faith or inspiration or connection to this idea of the inside of us there is, whether you know it or not, I kind of believe, there is this motivation, there's something inside of you that wants to be free. And if you're still enough or mindful enough, you can feel that. Something inside of you knows that path, knows that's the movement forward. And to follow that and to be dedicated to it and to really be able to stay in touch and really listen to that bodhicitta, to that aspiration for awakening, or aspiration for freedom, or the aspiration to be free of suffering. And it's so easy to lose touch with it, so easy to have other messages and other priorities and other values and other responsibilities and all kinds of other things come along that take precedence and cover it over. And one of the reasons to practice every day, to meditate every day, is independent of how good meditation is for you, is just to create the conditions where you're quiet enough, still enough, that inner expression has a chance to show itself. Because it's kind of shy, or it's kind of weak in many ways for many people. And so have some place in your life where this deeper thing can surface, you're in touch with it, and informs you and guides you and supports you as you go along. So I'll end with a story from a friend of mine, a story I like to tell. Some of you have heard it, I'm sure. In San Francisco, lives in Marin, there was a man who was ordained as a priest by Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. And his name is Lou Richmond, teaches up in San Rafael, I think, Mill Valley. And in the 1960s, as a young student of Suzuki Roshi, he asked Suzuki Roshi, "If I practice Zen, will I get enlightened?" You know, because you won't have a guarantee, right? And Suzuki Roshi said, "If your practice is sincere, it's almost as good." So maybe if you're sincere in your practice, you will partake with something that's almost as good as awakening. Perhaps some of the qualities or some of the characteristics of an awakened mind, a free mind, will be found in how you practice and sincerity of your practice. I think it's a beautiful thing to practice. And I am very, very grateful for all of you to come today. It's a wonderful thing, not only for yourself, but also for the world, that so many people would come and sit in a room that wasn't always quiet and still. But, you know, it's kind of a little bit like living in urban life, if what goes on here. And it's a great, great location to practice in, I think, in these conditions and challenges that it brings. And I thank you very much for coming and doing it and offering yourself in the practice. And each of you who came to practice here, whether you knew it or not, we're supporting the other people to come. I'm pretty sure that a good percentage of you probably would not have or could not have practiced all day if you were alone. But somehow by being through the group, that somehow that allowed you to continue and support. So each of you offer that support to others who needed it. So thank you. And